And welcome back to Coast. This hour, we'll take your phone calls with the interactive portion of the show with our guest, Michael Osterholm. His book, Deadliest Enemy, Our War Against Killer Germs. He was on years ago with us. Living Terrors was the name of that work. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back, Michael Osterholm with us. Deadliest Enemy is the name of the book, which came out just yesterday, didn't it, Michael?
Yes, it did.
And it's on Amazon. Did it hit bookstores yet, too?
It did. It's in bookstores, and it's being featured in several of the bookstore chains.
Great. Knowing what you know, what bothers you about this?
Well, there clearly is a future of infectious diseases with humans and animals that is going to look different than what we have to date. And what I mean by that is, as we were talking earlier, today the world is really a much more primed place for these infectious agents to spread. And Deadliest Enemies, Mark Olshaker and I talk about in detail, for example, just something as simple as the way that we make certain life-saving drugs today and why an infectious disease could actually disrupt that. It turns out that our group did a survey several years ago and said, and asked a group of PharmDs, doctorates in pharmacy, who cover the entire waterfront of medicine, and said, what are those life-saving drugs you have to have every day or people die? Right now, not cancer drugs, not lifestyle drugs, et cetera, but what's on the crash cart in the emergency room? And it turned out we came up with 30 different drugs that are absolutely critical to everyday survival of people.
And effective?
And effective. And it turns out that all 30 of those drugs are made outside the United States. Most are made in India and China, and they're all generic drugs. There's no stockpiles. It's kind of just-in-time delivery on the fast freighters that go from India and China to the United States or any other place in the world. If we have an influenza pandemic, a new strain of influenza where there's high absenteeism, lots of deaths anywhere in the world, where shipping is greatly disrupted, overnight, we will have major shortages of those drugs,
which
in turn will lead to collateral deaths that we hadn't even thought about because we don't have those drugs. So this just-in-time delivery world that we live in is very, very dependent on a world that works. And so anything that could disrupt it, like an infectious disease, is really a very, very serious challenge. And so we go through and talk about all these different reasons in today's world why we have such challenges. Just the number of people. Last year, about 1.5 billion people crossed a country border for purposes of tourism, which is a great thing. On the other hand, they bring diseases back with them. And today we see the challenges of that so that we can see an infectious agent that occurs anywhere in the world can overnight be everywhere in the world.
What about panic, Mark? What about panic if these drugs are unavailable? What could happen?
Well, that's one of the issues we talk about. In fact, in our book, we lay out this a critical agenda of what we must do today to minimize the impact of infectious diseases. Our whole goal is not to prevent death. I mean, when you think about this and understand that there's always going to be a top 10 causes of death. If we eliminate the current top 10, there'll be 10 new ones. I'm not sure they're any better than the 10 we have. But what we want to do is replace good deaths for bad deaths, meaning people who die young, people who die in the prime of their life, which many times infectious diseases do, are not the deaths we should be having. What we all want to do is get into our 90s. I want to be out trout fishing somewhere, get this big brook trout on, and have my heart attack and be laying face down in the water with this big smile on my face. Don't call that heart attack a bad death. Okay? And so what we're doing in the book is trying to say these are the kinds of deaths that we can avoid and can prevent. And that's what we should do. So that's what we try to do in the book is lay that out. And whether it's about global travel, whether it's products, whether it's food supply, one of the other areas we're very concerned about today is this issue with avian influenza. The flu viruses start in wild birds. That's where they normally reside. If they get into our poultry flocks today around the world, they are causing devastating impact. We saw in the United States here a year and a half ago, 52 million birds died in the upper Midwest as a result of avian flu that got into the turkey and chicken area. Well, today the fastest conversion of energy to protein is poultry. Some of your listeners may know this, but today on average the time from a chicken being hatched until that chicken breast is on your plate is about 35 days. Very efficient transfer of energy to protein. If we disrupt the large food supply chains of poultry, we have a real impact on the security of the food supply for people. Think about this. In Shanghai, China, Every month, about 100 million chickens are born in the peri-urban region of Shanghai, just to feed Shanghai. That is an ideal mixing vessel for influenza virus to get into those poultry. But also, if something happens to that, those people don't have that protein. And so we also are very concerned about that, and we address that in the book at some length, what we can do and must do to actually take that problem also off the table.
Let's take some calls for you, Michael, as they line up. We started off by going to David in St. Paul, Minnesota, east of the Rockies. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I had two quick questions, somewhat related. Is there any evidence that fluoride in our water harms us? And secondly, is there any credible evidence that any of these vaccinations are causing autism or other serious harm?
Yeah, thank you for the questions. And I mean, these are the kinds of questions that, unfortunately, I guess I would say, not distract public health, but that we spend so much time on, when we should be spending on time on questions about what kills us and what we could do something about. But so I'm glad you asked these questions because they really help us lay out the agenda. In terms of fluoride, a chemical that's put into the water supplies of many cities around the world actually has been shown time and time again to have a dramatic reduction in dental caries or cavities. And I actually happen to be the good fortunate recipient, having grown up in a small Iowa farm town where our dentist had actually been in the Navy in World War II and had done work with fluoride, and ours was the first town in all of Iowa to get fluoride in, and it turned out that we had a major reduction in dental caries cavities in our community, and I've been the recipient of good teeth for that reason. There is no evidence of any adverse event at the levels of fluoride we use. Now, there is a condition where too much fluoride in the water, which can occur in some naturally occurring waters of the world, where the fluoride is actually seeping out of the rock structure where the groundwater is, can cause some problems. But we monitor that closely. So it's like anything, you know, too little water, too much water in the human body, either you die from thirst or you basically die from drowning. You want to hit that middle spot. Well, fluoride is the same way. If you have the right amount, basically it's a very good thing with no adverse effects. In terms of, you know, looking at the issue of vaccines and safety, I can tell you again that those of us in public health look for signals all the time that something could be a problem, whether it's a drug, whether it's a vaccine, whether it's something in our food supply. And we monitor this very closely. And today there is zero evidence that measles vaccine causes autism. And there's been many studies. There's been many oversight groups that have looked at this. What unfortunately happened was one single physician made this claim in a study that has been totally discredited, where he made up the information, made up the data, continues to make a living off of selling this fear-mongering, which is the worst of what I consider kind of almost blood money in a sense, and it confuses parents because they hear this. Now, autism does occur, and autism has been increasing for a long time in terms of our modern-day healthcare system and assessment, and it's not completely clear why. There are some hints of certain environmental triggers, but has nothing to do with vaccines at any kind. And we just need to make sure the public knows that, because the flip side is that I've been there. I've actually been involved with outbreaks where I've watched children die from these vaccine-preventable diseases they shouldn't have gotten had they just had their children vaccinated.
And for those, Michael, who say, you know, all you do is put on anti-vaccine people and anti-fluoride people, there's the other side. We balance it out, don't we?
You sure do, and I appreciate that opportunity just to put the facts out there. And again, let me just say I'm a, you know, pretty educated guy. That doesn't mean that I'm bright or smart necessarily. There are educated people out there who make some pretty bad decisions, but just I'm a parent and a grandparent. And I look at all of these, not what it does to me, but I would guarantee you anything that I would never do anything to harm one of my children or grandchildren. And therefore, I can give you kind of my good housekeeping seal of approval by saying I couldn't imagine my kids not being vaccinated.
If you thought for just a split second that the combination of the measles, mumps, rubella shot, pertussis, whatever they put in there,
yep,
would cause autism with one of your grandkids, would you recommend don't get that kid vaccinated?
Well, I'd go one step further. I would not want those vaccines even to be made available. And I can give you an example of that. Back in 1976, I was part of a group of people that blew the whistle on the flu vaccine campaign that year, causing Guillain-Barré syndrome, this French polio, among those that got swine flu vaccine in 1976. I was part of the group that first called that question. It turned out that we now know we have a pretty good reason why that happened. It happened to be that the egg-based vaccines were not adequately purified to take out certain chemical structures.
It did happen, right?
It did happen.
It did happen.
Yeah. And that was flu, and that was unique to that event. And we monitor that closely. So we not only walk the talk, but we really do it. I mean, we actually, you know, we've been involved with situations like that. So yes, we would not even leave it up to a parent in the sense of saying this is dangerous, you may or may not want to take it. We would actually move immediately to make sure that product wasn't available to the public.
Michael, would you participate in a very fair debate on whether to vaccine with some doctors who say no, do not get vaccinated? Would you be part of that if we put it together?
I would. I think the only thing is that what happens is that, and this is why I appreciate your show, because you don't, you know, you try to just get the truth out there, is that in a sense it almost gives credibility to these groups. And, you know, one of the things that we didn't talk about this in our book because we really tried to stay with the priorities of what can public health do today. But in a sense, it's, you know, how do you refute people who make information up? And you say, well, that's just not true. And then people say, well, that's just government, you know, going after the little person, you know, and this person is a loner, and, but they must be telling the truth or they wouldn't be saying these things. And this has been a challenge, as these debates really have not effectively changed how the public thinks about this issue. And so we need a better way of, what do you trust? I mean, I would ask all of your listeners right now, who do you trust and why?
Well, see, that's the problem. I had a week or so ago a doctor on. He's a medical doctor from the University of California, and he hates the vaccine. And so when you hear him, the people who don't know, I don't know, most people don't, I mean, you folks do, they're confused.
And that's the case. And, you know, just because someone gets a medical degree or someone, you know, wears a badge or, you know, someone has had, you know, seminary training doesn't mean that they medically know everything or that they are always 100% law-abiding citizens or that they always preach the gospel and never do harm to anyone. And, you know, part of the challenge with that is the vast majority of those who go into those areas do an incredible job of representing medicine or law enforcement or religion. The problem is you have that one loner who doesn't, and then they become the credible voice or source of what appears to be the whole challenge of that particular topic. And so I think you raise a good point. Just because somebody has a medical degree doesn't mean that the body of science that's out there, they should somehow be able to disprove it and say it doesn't occur. We see the same thing with climate change and the issue with certain climatologists. You know, I use the old adage, as if, you know, 100 airplane engineers got in a plane and 98% said it's not safe and 2% said it was, would you still find it?
Probably not.
But if you listen to one of those 2%, you'd say it's no problem, go ahead and go.
Yeah. I've had a guest that I don't put on anymore, a doctor.
Yep.
Who would, you know, say things like, Dr. John Doe killed 25 patients with what he said and did. And I won't put the guy on because I need Dr. John Doe on to defend himself. And, you know, this program's not set up to indict people. I mean, we want the truth, as you said, but you got to temper that.
And, you know, and that's what we're trying to do in Deadliest Enemy. I hope that's why people will consider looking at this issue, because, you know, what we're trying to do there is lay out in very, very definitive terms, you know, A plus B plus C plus D. So you can watch the whole chain of events and why they would occur and what we can do about them to stop them. And I think that's what today we need more of, that kind of evidence-based approach where the average citizen can look at it and say, well, that makes sense to me. Let's do something about it.
Back to the calls. Tim in Michigan, first-time caller. Tim, good to have you with us. Go ahead.
Hey, George. Hey, Michael. How you doing, guys?
Good.
Thank you.
Hey, I'm going to start by stating I'm not really a doctor, but I play one at home with my kids.
You and a lot of other parents.
And, you know, I heard you talking about, you know, the prions.
Yes.
And I don't know how much you researched it, but I, you know, viruses don't bother me. You know, you're talking about vaccines. I was in the service. I was vaccinated for things I don't even know what I was vaccinated for. And you know what? I'm fine. My kids are all fine. They've had vaccines. But anyhow, getting back to prions. Were you aware that prions cannot be cooked out of your meat?
I'm sorry, prions cannot be what?
Cooked out.
They can't be cooked out of your meat.
Yes, I am very aware of that.
Right, and you know the consequences of it, right?
Well, it depends upon which kind of prion it is. For example, there are some very specific species-related prions that are a challenge. Now, I gave the example earlier of what we call bovine spongiform encephalopathy or mad cow disease. There's a case where the prion that's actually in cattle, when that meat is consumed by humans, particularly certain parts of the animal, where there's heavy concentrations of neurologic tissue or nerves, that can transmit to people. On the other hand, we have other diseases. A good example is one called scrapie, which is a prion disease of sheep, where the reason it got its name is because these animals eventually just scrape away all of their fur and hide as such because of the virus that makes them do that kind of action. And there we don't have any evidence that that can actually infect humans. And the same thing is true today with the chronic wasting syndrome we see in white-tailed deer and elk. We have no evidence that though there's been large consumption of likely contaminated meat with prions in deer that were shot and no one knew that they actually had it, ever transmitted to humans. So one of the challenges we have today is which prions can then transmit to humans and which ones can't. And so that, and you're absolutely right, these prions are very, very hardy, and we can't kill it. In fact, we have a problem today in human medicine where there's another type of prion-related disease called Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. And this is a naturally occurring one in humans.
Mad cow disease, right?
And occasionally we have people who have brain surgery because they don't understand what's going on, and so they go in and operate, and it turns out that you can't adequately disinfect the surgical equipment with normal sterilization that we use against prions. And so we always worry about that. Could you have actually transmitted the virus to the next person that had the equipment used on them? And so, yes, this is a very difficult agent to kill.
What is this necrotizing fasciitis that people jump in a lake to go swimming and they come back with this horrible, wretched bacteria, this bacteria that eats their flesh, Michael?
Right. Actually, and this one is kind of a combination of things. Necrotizing fasciitis is basically what we call in the old days flesh-eating strep. And that is a type of staphylococcal bacteria and streptococcal bacteria, mostly strep, but some staph, that produces a toxin that basically disintegrates the muscle tissue as such and what holds the muscle tissue together. That often requires actually surgical intervention to stop it from spreading. Kind of think of like the old days of snake venom.
20,000 U.S. cases a year, by the way.
Right, exactly. And that's actually a common bacteria that can be transmitted by people. And I've actually worked up large outbreaks of it where we actually had school children transmitted from one child to the other just by close contact.
Nice.
Now, in the swimming part you were talking about, that's actually another disease called Naegleria fowleri, or a type of meningitis, where there's a parasite type of infectious agent in the water that actually gets into the nose area.
Yeah, how would you know?
As a result of water getting into your nose when you're diving, whatever, and then it makes its way to the brain.
What a horrible infliction. Horrible. Michael, we're going to come back and take some final calls next. Welcome back. Our final segment with Michael Osterholm, Deadliest Enemies, the name of his book. Michael, you were just talking about that bacteria in lakes. 7-year-old boy died a couple years ago, after going swimming in a lake on a family vacation. Health officials suspect that may have been done to severe bacterial infection. He was from Texas. He was vacationing in the San Diego area. He fell sick after being in and out of the water at Camp Pendleton's Lake O'Neill Recreational Park. Does it get any sadder with a little tiny 7-year-old boy swimming around in the lake? He's got his little goggles on, and this bacteria goes up his nose or whatever, and then he ends up dying. Horrible.
It's a horrible situation. Unfortunately, we've had two cases in Minnesota that occurred several years apart, and actually from swimming in the same lake, in the same public beach area.
Oh.
And so that this is a real challenge. And it's one that, again, though, And I surely don't want to minimize these cases. These are children who have been taken from their parents. I actually happen to know one of the families in Minnesota that before the event even happened, and so it's just heart-tugging. But again, coming back to what we talk about in Deadliest Enemies, here we're talking about what are the things that can really have catastrophic impact, where many thousands and thousands of people die. Antibiotic resistance is a good example of that. When we talk about, you know, trying to replace good deaths and bad deaths, is the fact that when you look at the pre-antibiotic era, before the 1930s, people died frequently from just common kinds of infectious diseases that today we just take for granted because we have antibiotics. Well, we're losing our antibiotics today. We don't. What's happened is with the evolution of the bacteria in particular, they have developed through mutations ways to get around these antibiotics to basically make them non-effective. And so we're beginning to see kind of a post-antibiotic era. So for 80,000 generations from the caves to our great-grandparents, you know, we didn't have antibiotics and a lot of people died. We've had a really wonderful run with these antibiotics, but because of overuse and just natural evolution, we now see so many more infections that we are getting harder, it's getting harder and harder to treat them. And so we worry that the kind of thing you talked about, these kids in the lake, actually become a common thing from just getting a cut in your hand. That's what we really worry about, and that's another one of the things we address in the book, because this is something we can do something about. We can't stop it, but how we find new drugs, how we find vaccines that can take on some of these infectious agents that now today we treat, and how we slow down the overuse of antibiotics now that actually accelerate this resistance developing through the mutational process is really important. Just one last factoid for the audience here. Think about this. An E. coli bacteria creates a new generation every 20 minutes. And if they don't have certain mutations occur or changes in their genes because of an antibiotic, they die. But for those that do change, they survive and now they're resistant against the antibiotic. Well, for every 20 minutes, you take your years of life and figure out how many generations one E. coli has gone through since you were born, and you're one generation right now. It's amazing what microbes can do.
Why didn't we hear about this disease in lakes when you and I were kids, Michael?
Well, actually, we didn't hear about it for two reasons. One is the fact that it appears that it's actually occurring more frequently now, and that may be due to better diagnosis in part, because this is somewhat hard to diagnose. But it's also likely due to some of the warming in the waters we see. And this is one of the, frankly, the concerning areas of climate change we worry about. As bodies of water warm, this particular infectious agent does very well. It's called McLarii. And we worry that actually we're going to see more and more of these cases associated with warmer waters. And this would be a real concern if that were to happen.
Lynn is in Orange, California. Welcome to the program, Lynn. Go ahead.
What I was curious about as an infectious disease specialist, your thoughts of Dr. Thomas Levy, L-E-V-Y, Johns Hopkins trained and Tulane trained, who teaches seminars to doctors about his protocol and documents everything just like a lawyer, because he is also a lawyer as well as a doctor, about the use of ascorbic acid for pretty much a broad spectrum of what you've been talking about in every level tonight. And using 10, 20, 30, 50, 100 grams of ascorbic acid for solutions where antibiotics destroys the gut, ascorbic acid, vitamin C, does not. So I was wondering, you yourself, have you interacted with ascorbic acid for making any solutions?
Some studies, Michael, say that vitamin C in high doses could be very powerful.
Right, and let me just say right up front, I'm not a primary expert in this issue other than having studied it a bit myself as almost a citizen would do it. You know, we go back a number of years on this issue. In fact, Linus Pauling, as you may recall, put forward, you know, a very bright man, the idea of high doses of vitamin C. And what studies we have to date that I have seen do not bear out the fact that there are these major health benefits that occur from these high doses. Surely vitamin C as a necessary vitamin is needed at the levels that we traditionally talk about in regular vitamins and diet intake. And there is a downside. We know that high levels of vitamin C can actually be detrimental to health. And so I can't answer the question about what this particular physician is saying about this. I don't know that information that he is saying, but I would be very cautious. Anytime someone has a magic bullet by just more of a chemical, something like that, that is always a red flag for me. And unless the data bear out that, you know, in double-blind controlled trials, meaning that neither the investigator or the person who's getting the drug or vaccine or whatever knows who's getting which and who's getting some kind of a sham, you know, just inert chemical like saline, that you have to always really look at those studies that aren't done like that with a real challenge to yourself and what you're thinking about. So I can't comment on this other than to say that I know of no data that supports that these high doses has really any impact on infectious diseases at all.
Michael, what's the message you want people to bring from reading Deadliest Enemy?
The first message is that we're in very challenging times with infectious diseases, and that's because of world population growth, the way we move around the world today with our trade and travel and the speed at which we do that, and the mixing and matching, and that we're not keeping up with it in terms of our investment in public health and trying to stop these infections, either getting better vaccines like we need for influenza and the potential impact that an influenza pandemic could have, or antibiotic resistance. The fact that other diseases like Ebola or MERS, or the things we talked about earlier, are going to have major impact on regions of the world. Look what Zika has done. Here's a virus that came via mosquitoes to the Americas, hadn't been seen prior to 2 years ago, and now we're creating an entire generation of young children with severe brain damage in the Americas where this is happening.
Sad story.
That's the kind of thing that we should be anticipating and really working on and investing. And what I worry about is we're not only not investing in it, but that we're divesting in a sense. And over the next several years, there's a chance not in the United States, but even in Europe and elsewhere in the world, that we're going to spend less money on this. And that would be penny wise and pound foolish.
Bill is in West Hartford, Connecticut. Hey, William, welcome back.
Yes, hi, George. Hi, Michael. I have a great question for you that involves microbes and viruses in relation to our space program, NASA. What I want to ask you is, NASA just finished a year ago this month the one-year microbiological space mission with the Kelly brothers, astronauts Scott Kelly and his brother Mark Kelly, who remained on Earth as a control. Well, astronaut Scott Kelly was in the International Space Station for a whole year with a Russian cosmonaut as well, and the first data started to come out a few weeks ago. Most of the of that mission was about taking blood samples and other things, urine and so forth, regarding the microbiome of astronaut Scott Kelly being in weightlessness for a full year, and his immunity as well. What I want to ask you specifically is, what benefits will us humans here on Earth get from that year-long space mission regarding fighting bacteria and viruses?
Well, thank you for that question, because it actually opens up the door, you might say, to an even larger question. And you use the term microbiome, which is a very important term today. It turns out that our body are swimming in microorganisms. There's actually more microbes living in your gut than there are total cells in your body. And we need these. They're what we call commensals, where basically they do a benefit for us. We provide them a place to reside. If we didn't have them, we couldn't digest our food, any number of things that we need in our body. The same thing is true even with our skin bacteria. Healthy skin bacteria actually helps keep away the bad bacteria. They compete for the same space. And so what we haven't understood for many decades with the use of antibiotics is that, yes, we need those antibiotics when we have a bad bacteria or in this antiviral in the case of a bad virus. And when we use drugs like antibiotics, we actually have a big impact on the microbiome. We change it. We take out that kind of flora or the bacteria that normally there that's healthy. And so we are starting to see more problems and we actually have diseases today that are actually caused by bad bacteria coming in where good bacteria used to reside, and we accidentally killed it. We didn't mean to. So the space program example you gave is just one more example to see how does the microbiome, that healthy part of microbes, actually reside in our body and what changes occur. In this case, what happens when you go to space. You know, I'm always taken back by some certain kinds of entertainers and news commentators and talk show hosts who, in this program an exception here, this is not the case here, so let me be clear about that, but where they you know, are so frightened by any microbe. Somebody comes in and takes a swab and, you know, rubs it across the telephone and says, oh my gosh, there's my bacteria here, and they it's like somehow these are all bad, and many of them are actually very good. So what we're learning today is that one of the ways to stay healthy is making sure that we had healthy bacteria with us and not the bad bacteria. And we need to do much more work, and this is what the space program study is working on right now, is how does that change occur. And I think the data, as you pointed out, are just starting to come out, and we really need more information about that. But we live with microbes. They're going to be here before we were here. They're here while we're here. They're going to be here long after we're gone. What we need to do is learn how to live with them and hopefully not have to fight them.
Michael, I know a lot of people who are so germophobic. I mean, yep. they don't want to shake hands. They don't want to do anything. I remember years ago I was at a business meeting, and I had a little tiny company, and one of my stockholder partners was waiting for the meeting to start with me, and the people hadn't arrived yet. He sneezed in his hands. Then they come through the door, and we're all shaking hands, and of course they're shaking his. He didn't wipe his hands, nothing like that. And I'm thinking, oh, does it get any grosser than that? But
you're right. You're absolutely right. I can't say that. That's why, you know, we have this kind of new handshake in the public health.
Knuckle punches.
Elbow to elbow.
Yeah.
And again, you know, this is one of the things where our grandmothers were right. Hand washing is something that's very good. I just talked about the healthy microbiome. But, you know, just to wash off the kind of germs that get on your hand from all those contacts is a good thing to do. And after using the bathroom, it's the other thing that, you know, you talked about the sneeze, but how many times have you been in the bathroom where somebody gets up out of the stall and leaves without washing their hands?
Oh, my God, yeah.
And so I think these are both very important public health.
Or touching the door when you leave. I always use a paper towel to open up the door.
In Deadliest Enemies, this is what we try to do, is we try to kind of, you know, separate out fact from fiction. What are the things that are really most likely to have a really detrimental impact on us, and which are not? And, you know, hand washing is one of those things that helped get us to this. When you think about this, just think about the fact that in 1900, average life expectancy in this country was 48 years. It took us 80,000 generations from the caves to get to 48 years. Today, life expectancy is 78 years.
Isn't that amazing?
For every 3 days we've lived in the last century, we gained a day of life expectancy.
And with stem cells, it's going to get higher.
It is, but the key message is to remember that the reason that primary change occurred initially is from the standpoint of eliminating certain infectious diseases that killed us very young. And the challenge we have today is we're starting to see those risk factors coming back again, whether it be global sanitation, whether it be loss of antibiotics, whether it be people not getting vaccinated or not having the vaccines they need. So these are all big challenges. And then you lay on top of the issue, the questions you asked early on about bioterrorism, and the kind of things we can do with designer bacteria today. Think about this. We're doing research in high school laboratories today on microbes that 20 years ago could only be done in the highest security, most well-funded laboratories of places like the United States and USSR. And so that one of the challenges we have today is just like, you know, 10 years ago, imagine where you were before the iPhone. Well, now we have these capabilities from a technology standpoint to change microbes, and people with very little training and with very little knowledge of what they're doing can do that. That's scary. So one of the things we have to focus on today are what are those things that are really going to potentially harm us, and that's what we try to do in Deadliest Enemies.
Let's go to Carol in Connecticut, first-time caller. Carol, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi there.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I'm 64 years old, and when I was between the ages of about 4 and 10 or 11, I had every single childhood disease, plus Asian flu and scarlet fever, and they think even rheumatic fever. And back then, there's no drugs, there was no medicine. They didn't take you to the hospital. The doctor would come and see you at your house, and that was all. And how come I never had any bad side effects and survived all that through all those years? And I'm missing.
You know what? First of all, congratulations and good luck. Okay, you did survive, and many of us did. We did have antibiotics back in those early days.
Maybe a different immune system.
But the point is, a lot of people didn't survive, And, you know, that's the challenge is that we always have examples of people did. But if you look at the number of deaths due to just the current common vaccine-preventable diseases, mumps, measles, rubella, et cetera, the number of children who died right up through the 1960s and into the 70s before those vaccines is remarkable relative to today. And so one of the challenges we have is, you know, we all have our stories of having survived and gotten through. I had some infections as a young child. Fortunately, we had penicillin at the time. I had a sister who was just a little younger than you who had a very severe kidney infection that 20 years before, 30 years before, she probably would have died from it. But because of antibiotics, she survived. And so we surely do know that people survived. You know, civilization obviously made its way all the way from the caves to 1900 to get there. But we had many deaths along the way that occurred because of that. And what we're seeing today is the concern that we're going to go back more and more to those because of the relative loss of antibiotics, because of the problems globally with the world population explosion in the megacities of the developing world where, you know, if Dickens were alive today, he'd have a hard time adequately describing the deplorable conditions that these people live in and put themselves at high risk for infectious diseases.
In my day, Michael, people were petrified of polio, of course, which usually spread from person to person through infected matter, didn't it?
Mm-hmm. It was actually what we call fecal-oral transmission, or just that, not washing your hands well enough for a contaminated environment.
Why was it so prevalent in the United States? People just weren't sanitary?
Well, no, it's, you know, it's actually one of those things where, again, think of young children today. We have a challenge in child daycare facilities where if you have a lot of pre-toilet trained children, you're just trying to contain all of that is a challenge. You know, we see it when we go to water parks today, when we have these kids are in these supposedly swimming diapers, but we know they leak like the devil.
Oh my God, they're saggy.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, we still have that challenge today. The big difference, of course, between then and now, when you talk about polio, is polio vaccine. I mean, we talk about this in the book. You know, Jonas Salk literally became an American hero when he was asked who owns the polio vaccine, and he said, everyone does.
That was so right on, too. Michael, thank you for being on the program. The name of the book, Deadly as Enemy, Our War Against Killer Germs. Good to have you back on Coast to Coast. Up next, Harold Roth joins me as we talk about the witching herbs.